The book that much of the conversation is happening around resilience by a guy named Andrew Zolli. He's kind of a social philosopher, but his book, Resilience, Why Things Bounce Back, talks about organizations, groups, schools, families, little organizations, big organizations, but why do some organizations last and some don't? Why do some groups survive and some don't? So best way to introduce resilience before we do something else for just a moment is to think about the difference from the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s between the business models of Blockbuster Video and Netflix. All right, so Blockbuster had stores. You went, rented a movie, took it home, then you had to take it back. Then this thing called Netflix came out that we'll just mail them straight to your door. You don't have to go to a store or anything. So you had competition between these two businesses, and then streaming happened. And that's when Netflix perfected the model, and we all know what happened to Blockbuster. They didn't keep up with the times. And so how does one company cultivate resilience and another does not? And so what Zolli has been doing in his research and his work is talking about everything. Businesses, schools, churches, nonprofit organizations, and he's applying these ideas about resilience to just about everything. So we'll talk about that here in a little bit. What have we done so far? So far, just a couple of points of review. It's important, again, in this class to emphasize that strategically small doesn't mean intentionally small. And I think we've made that point quite a bit in the class so far. So if you're listening online, classes 1 and 2 cover all of this. That we don't do this from a place of arrogance or pride, but gratitude. This is not a sour grapes thing, you know, where we talk about how, you know, well, we've got this wonderful family-sized church. We're so much better than X church down the street. It's not about that. It's rather just saying we're grateful for who we are, what we have here, and that's enough. The problem, though, that many of the family-sized churches that are our size and a little bit smaller face is the temptation to be a mini megachurch. That is, we've got churches that are more program-based, and so we need to do all of the same things. And, you know, when you do that, you start emphasizing what we are supposed to be or what we should be, rather than who we are. And so a lot of the literature on family-sized churches says, instead, start with where you are, and then play to your strengths, which is an extremely important point, play to your strengths, and then if you see an area that needs attention, focus attention on that area, but don't try to focus attention on 20 areas. Because then what happens in a church our size, if you try to focus on 20 things that need attention, is that you wind up doing all of them mediocre. So what this is saying is instead, all right, if you have a point that needs attention, pour attention into a single thing, but don't try to do everything all at once. So the solution to this temptation to be a mini program-based church is you start asking, okay, why are we here? And I think that this question is important no matter what size you get, because I've been with large program-based churches, and it's just as easy in larger program-based churches to lose sight of what is the point of church as it is in a smaller family-sized church. This one is not, you know, limited to just a certain size. It's easy to lose sight of what the point of church is. And so one of the things that we'll keep doing this week and next week is coming back and continuing to state, what is the point of church? We carry out the mission of God. We're shaped in the image and likeness of Christ. No matter who we are, you know, if there are 30 people in this class or 300, this is a question we always have to keep before us. And so, but again, we've made that. So here's what we want to do at the beginning. Pat Schrader and I were talking after class last week, and one of the things that she said, we've been telling some of our stories, and so she said, you know, at this point, before we move on to the stuff about resilience, what if we keep telling our stories? because somebody, I think it was David, talked about whenever you guys moved here as a young married couple, Tamara was in the hospital, you were surrounded by people who literally took you under their wing and took care of you. So I'm curious, especially on what we were talking about over the last 2 weeks, on some of the hallmarks of family-sized churches, authenticity, family, and just intergenerational dynamics being together, to hear a few more of your stories. What are some of your stories from life here at Bearing, particularly that highlight these things, authenticity, family, and being more intergenerational? We just would like to get on record a few more of these stories before we move on to the next great thing. So, yes, hang on a second. Don, we're ready. All right, Linda has the floor.
I can't think of, when I think of the word intergenerational, I think of the prayer partner ministry.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess that's because I've been so involved in it. But that was the brainchild of Melanie Simpson. And then after Melanie left, I worked with it. And it was amazing to me to see the wonderful things that God wrought from that. I would match up names of kids with the names of adults who signed up, and I would try to provide the adults with a little bit of information about the child, and then I just let go.
Yeah.
And that was one of those times of really letting go and letting God.
Yeah.
And I have one gentleman who has had the same prayer partner for 5 or 6 years now, and he said, "You're not taking him away from me." And I know in my own grandchildren's lives, those bonds formed as a result of the prayer partner ministry has just encouraged them. And it's not only a dynamic that joins children and adults, but it joins families together.
Right.
And because if you're working with a child, you've got to get to know the parents. Now, parents have got to get to know the child's prayer partner, and I just think it has strengthened the family here at Bearing.
Yeah, wonderful.
My opinion.
No, it's wonderful. A lot of us have benefited from that in our homes, so, yes. What else? What else has been moments for you? Tim?
So one of the things that Bridget and I have appreciated has been kind of the fostering of the young adults with some of the older couples in the church. And so going over to the Riddle's house for a cookout, or to the Schrader's house for a game night,
right.
Or to any or to the the Smiths and also the Redmonds, yeah. And it's not only fosters getting to know getting to know the Redmonds or the Schraders or the Smiths, but it also fosters the community between the young adults.
Yeah.
And so it's a way to foster that relationship both ways.
Yeah, yeah. One of the big points that we went over last week in point three of just intergenerational dynamics is how important it is to spend time outside of the Sunday morning hours, just getting to know each other. Sometimes even just without an agenda, just get together, spend time together, and how important that is. So yeah, thanks for sharing that, Tim. What else? What else has been your experience at Bearing that plays to some of these strengths that we've talked about over the last couple of weeks? Yes, Rebecca.
Right after Paul and I got married, we were selling my townhouse because it was kind of small for the two of us to fit in. And we had it listed. We'd found the place we wanted to live, but the folks that were living there wanted to keep it longer. And we were like, well, no, we haven't had any action on our house, so we'll just stay in our house. And when we need to move in 2 months, that'll be fine.
Yeah.
Well, as you know how God has a sense of humor, about a week and a half later, our house sold. And we were going to be homeless for about 8 weeks.
Yeah.
I was at a baby shower for Stacey Mullinax, and I was talking to someone about it, and Jenna Rubman comes up to me and goes, I'm going to call you later tonight. I said, okay. So we get a call, and we get a gracious invitation to house sit. Yeah, and most of you have been to their house. You know what a hard job that was. But, because we were thinking we were going to have to live at an extended stay.
Right,
It was going to be a really big, hard thing for a newly married couple to go through. And they opened up their home to us for 8 weeks. We house sat. We moved into our house, and she brings us dinner.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just one of those family things that I don't know we would have gotten at another church that
right.
was a big church.
Right, right.
Could I follow up on
sure,
that?
Sure, of course.
In addition to providing us, a place to be in out of the cold, well, out of the heat, actually, summertime.
Out of the winter humidity.
That six week stay really helped us establish a friendship with
exactly.
the Redmonds that continues to this day.
Yep.
And that friendship also blossomed into relationships with several Lifeline interns who have been with us over the different summers in the years since then. And so, I guess my point is that these family things have ripple effects.
They do.
Positive ripple effects in terms of the building of relationships over time.
Yes.
And the strengthening of people over time.
Yeah. Yeah. Bridget and then Jennifer.
To follow up with Paul, it is so encouraging to be blessed by the older community here at Bering by welcoming us into their homes for parties and just even phone calls or a pat on the shoulder and say, hey, I'm thinking about you and maybe here's a dinner too. Things like that are so encouraging to us. We are so inspired to do that to others.
Exactly.
To those younger than us and older than us, and it kind of sets a precedence ripple effect, like Paul said, and it shows us what has been so valuable to us can mean the world to others.
Yeah.
So we look for the need and search for where we can fill it.
Good. Excellent. Yeah, when we were house hunting here, we specifically said we don't want to stay in a hotel. We want to stay with one of the families in the church. And so Randy and Lynn Milliken put us up for a few days. And one of the mornings when we woke up, the kids were already awake. Jennifer and I came downstairs, and Lynn was sitting at the table doing science experiments with Cole and Reese. And they still talk about it to this day. One simple moment, again, outside of the Sunday morning hour, to borrow the language from a moment ago, has ripple effects that you cannot measure. And again, to an earlier point in class one, you can't manufacture it. You can't fake it. Okay, you can't say, well, then we need to apply this to our church because it'll make us a better church. Instead, it's, I think somebody said last week, it's a little more organic, but those moments really build community. That's wonderful. Jen.
One of my favorite moments is the youth, quote-unquote, youth group mission trip to Honduras.
Yeah.
And it was the youth group, but there were as many adults as there were kids. And even the director of the place that we went in Honduras commented on how, he was like, you guys enjoy being around each other so much. Reese came home, and she was like, I just love Sarah Pivas. She's a dear friend. She's a good friend with Abby. We really developed intergenerational bonds, and my kids can go up to any of those people. We have these shared experiences, and it was so noticeable even to people from the outside that we had something special.
Yep. We did construction together. We ate together. We got sick together. The key phrase Jen just used was it was a shared experience. And that's what Jared, the director of Mission Lazarus, talked to us about. He said, we have groups coming in here every week. And he said 9 out of 10 groups that come through here, the adult sponsors kind of sit at a table on their own during breakfast and dinner time, and then the kids hang out, and in the evening the kids hang out with each other, the adults, and that dynamic was different with our group. And again, back to an earlier point, this is not saying, look how much better we are than you. It is to say, though, that there are strengths to that. And so we play to our strengths. We emphasize what we have and go with it. So, good. Dwayne, and then we will do some stuff with resilience.
When Barbara and I were getting ready to build our home some 10, 11 years ago, we put our house on the market, and it sold in 24 hours. So we needed a place to stay, and the Frombergs offered us their upstairs, and we were with them for 18 months and had all things in common. And I don't remember a single fuss or fight.
Oh, excellent. Hang on. We're recording, so we've got to get you on mic.
Okay. I want to add that. Thank you, Don. You're not going to hold it for me. Because the Evans were living with my parents, we have dinner at my parents' house every Monday night. So Abby Lehman Austin also grew relationships with Barbara and Dwayne, which is really, really cool.
It is.
Awesome.
Great. What's that? Yeah.
100 occasions every Sunday for 100 Sundays. V and I enjoyed the company of individuals. We talked and we laughed. We told stories. And we stayed a while. And I said, wasn't that fun? She says, that was marvelous. We have such a great family. She said, but I wish you'd stop talking so much.
Excellent. It is authenticity. Amen. So far, what we've done in this class is to emphasize these three unique advantages that family-sized churches have that you can't necessarily replicate in the same way in larger program-based churches. Some of what we've said, though, is new. Some of it is, I've never thought of it that way. Some of the things might have even, I don't necessarily agree with that, and that's okay. Because what we're going to do for the rest of this morning and next week is step back from what we've done with authenticity, family, and intergenerational, and encircle it with an idea that informs these things. And so we're leaving this material and doing something different. Okay? But in doing something different, so that we don't just kind of repeat ourselves and say the same thing over and over again, this language of resilience is going to, again, inform what we've done so far and ask a pretty primary question. And that is, if we have, you know, a wonderful family-sized church that we're welcoming people into, the big question is, how do we keep it? How do we maintain this? How do we give thanks to God for where we are now and then pray and put things in place that say, how do we get to continue to thank God for these things for years into the future? Because we are at kind of a turning point in the life cycle of a church. Okay? People who study church dynamics, ecclesiology, church growth, however you want to put it, people who study church say the 50-year mark is always a tipping point for the life of a church. The 50-year mark is the one that you either, pardon the language, make it or break it. Because what happens at the 50-year mark in the life of a church is that your charter members, people who've been there from the very beginning, either are older adults who cycle out of leadership, you know, or they've passed on. And so then, how do you take what was the original vision of the church and continue to cultivate that original vision? That 50-year mark is key. Okay? And churches who know that and who understand that tend to make it through the 50-year mark and thrive. The churches that have trouble with it are the ones who don't know. They don't have that realization. And so they keep trying to be who they've always been, and then, you know, unfortunately, and some of us have probably even seen and experienced this, you blow up and dry away. You know, and again, pardon the language, I know that's kind of crude, but that is what happens. So knowing that trajectory, understanding the 50-year mark in the life cycle of a church, what do we do to keep on keeping on? How do we be a Netflix church rather than a Blockbuster Video church? You know, how do we be the Rolling Stones instead of the Beatles? Okay, so I know a few of you appreciate that. Because what happened? What happened to the Beatles in the late 60s and early 70s? Personal quarrels tore them apart. So how is it that, you know, pardon Bill Wyman leaving the Stones, how is it that Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, Charlie Watts, and Ron Wood are playing together to this day? How's that happening? Well, some of the resilience material will go over that. So, again, Norton. Here we go. So borrowing a lot of material from Andrew Zolli's book, Resilience, Why Things Bounce Back. First, let's define this, because resilience, especially the way we're talking about it, may be a new word. Resilience is the capacity of a system, enterprise, or a person to maintain its core purpose and integrity in the face of dramatically changed or changing circumstances. Okay, so just get a definition out on the table. That's where we begin. So starting with that, you have to ask two questions. Question number one, and then another question number one. Number one, does my church have a clearly stated purpose or mission? Okay, this is key. If we don't have a clearly stated purpose, then we are not going to know what we're supposed to do 10 years from now or 20 years from now. And so it has to be a clearly stated purpose. Mission statements got real popular among churches in the 1980s and 90s. And 99 out of 100 wound up with a mission statement that came out of a committee that wound up being 5 or 6 lines long that no one could remember. And so, you know, when we realized that, people who studied church and church dynamics started asking, well then, what are we supposed to do with this mission statement that no one can remember? And so that's when mission statements started getting, you know, clearer. But it's also when we started asking, what is the purpose of our church? And that's what drove trying to state, here's what our purpose is in the life of a church. And then the other question, number one, is just as critical, if not more critical. And that is my church carrying out that purpose in the face of dramatically changing circumstances? Right? So again, back to Netflix and Blockbuster. Netflix was able to survive because they said, we have to deliver movies, documentaries, and television shows in a way that's going to keep up with the times. In a way that's going to say, we're not going to just operate our business model the way that we've always done it and hang on for dear life. Because that's what Blockbuster did. And when they hung on for dear life, they died. And so as kind of a warning story, how then do we do something else? And so these questions are critical. So you identify the purpose, back to the definition of resilience, with a commitment to consistency. That is, we have a purpose. Our church knows what our purpose is, but we maintain that purpose consistently. And then you have to identify what these changes are. You can't pretend like the changes aren't there. Changes are here. And so how do we do this with a commitment to resilience? We're just getting this stuff out on the table. We'll talk about the hows, whys, and wheres as we get deeper into this. When I told this story at ACU, when I taught this material out there, I said, well, here's what my church does. I can't write your mission statement. I can't write your purpose. So what we did, the pastoral team and staff last year, is that we took the mission statement that was 4 or 5 lines long that no one could remember and say, what are really the key points here? What are the cogent points that you cannot separate out? And so we were able to come up with love and serve God and people. Now, 20 years from now, you know, who knows what group is going to say, we need to change our mission statement. That's fine. Again, that's what you do in a group of people that continues, you know, to flow. That's a fluid group, so that's okay. But for now, again, playing to our strengths and playing to who we are right now, this seemed to make the most sense. You know, what are we supposed to do? You know, back to the core of Jesus' teaching, it all came down to love God and love your neighbor. So we started there. Because then what a purpose like this is going to do is it's going to call everything into question that is not engaged in loving God, serving people, serving God. If it's not doing that, then why are we doing it? Okay, so it kind of not only is a mission statement or a purpose statement, but it's a grid. Everything goes through that. It's a filter for everything we do in the life of the church. But here's the trick. And it's what complicates things, is that we have to practice that within a setting that's constantly changing. Okay, so to something that David said, I believe last year when we started talking about who we are here right now. When the Bering Drive Church of Christ formed in the early to mid 60s, this building was built in a pasture. You know, and that's hard for some of us to fathom, especially if we've only lived here for the last decade or so. It's hard to fathom that this was on the outskirts of town, you know, especially because now outskirts of town is 30 minutes to an hour from here, depending on which direction you go. This is one of the functioning 3 or 4 downtown areas in Houston, the Galleria District. When people ask me who don't live here, where do you live in Houston? That's where you start. You know where the Galleria is? Yeah, sure. That's where we are. You know, in a major metropolitan thriving area. Okay, so there's one of the changing settings. Here's another big one. Probably in the 1960s, in this area, the demographics were pretty monochromatic. That is, it was probably middle to upper middle class Anglo-Americans. Is that fair? For those of us who live in this neighborhood, it doesn't look like that anymore. It's completely changed. And so knowing that things have changed, we have to ask ourselves as a church, where do we go from here? And one of the things that we have emphasized, particularly over the last 5 to 10 years, is everyone who walks through our doors is going to be welcomed. And it is our prayer, it is our absolute prayer, that not only is everyone welcomed who comes through these doors, but that they can actually find a place to call home, to have a family. And thanks to that commitment and your sweet hearts, a lot of people who've walked through the doors over the last 5 to 10 years have found a home. And I'm personally very grateful for that. So let's pause for a moment and discuss this before we go any farther. So Don will have the roving microphone again, but questions, comments, additions, challenges, whatever. Let's start opening this to discussion. Yes.
Like to welcome the piano in the front of the church.
Yeah.
That's how far we've come, people.
True. Alan has a comment.
Jeff, the key I see to bearing and having worked with churches and thing is there's a flexibility here, an adaptive attitude.
Yeah.
And churches that don't have that, even at that 50-year mark, tend to fizzle.
Yes, that is true. Yeah. Flexibility, adaptivity, freedom, whatever you want to call it. These are key points. What else? Yes, Paul has one. Yeah, and in the resilience literature, that adaptive personality to a group is absolutely key. So thanks for sharing that. Yes, Paul.
Following up on Alan's comment, I think that an important part of that adaptiveness is a willingness to welcome and embrace people who look different than quote unquote us.
Sure, sure.
Quote unquote us is always changing, by the way.
It is.
But to welcome people who may look and think and perhaps even behave and have different backgrounds than the, if you will, the dominant culture of the group at any given time.
Right.
Some groups filter such people out.
They do.
You know, you walk in and you immediately know you don't fit. And you never walk in again.
Yeah.
Some other places, and we strive to be such a place, you walk in and it may be that a lot of people look similar, but you don't feel like you don't belong.
Right.
And over time, the makeup of that group of people is going to look a little different.
Yep.
And I think that's really critical, and I think it's important not only in terms of race and ethnicity, but also in terms of heritage within the Christian family.
Right.
And all that goes with that.
Yep.
And there are lots of other factors too, but I'll stop there.
Sure. You have something, Tom?
Jeff, contrasting programs in organized religion in contrast to personal responsibility, I would share a brief story.
Sure.
About what has probably been a series of unsuccessful greeting programs.
Of what programs?
Greeting, where
greeting?
We have
okay.
selected people. I've been on it.
Yeah.
And we sat at the door, and nobody ever shows up, and we have a tag on that says special greeter, and all of that's good.
Yeah.
And they always have fallen apart. What continues to work are people around this church that spot a visitor immediately and just personally say hello.
Yeah.
So I don't know that it's better than an organized greeter program, but certainly it works.
Yeah.
Without it having to be organized.
Yeah. Yeah, we practice here a greethood of all believers. That one's free. I just came up with that.
There's one thing that I think we need to keep in mind. It's been best said by Michael Green, who wrote the book Evangelism in the Early Church. This evangelism must often have been formal, not formal preaching, but informal chattering to friends and chance acquaintances in homes and wine shops, on walks and around market stalls. They went everywhere gossiping the gospel. I like that phrase, gossiping the gospel. They did it naturally, enthusiastically, and with the conviction of those who are not paid to say that sort of thing. Consequently, they were taken seriously. They went everywhere gossiping the gospel. He goes on to say it would be a gross mistake to suppose that the apostles sat down and worked out a plan of campaign, the spread of Christianity was, as we have seen, largely accomplished by informal missionaries and must have been, to a large extent, haphazard and spontaneous. I think what we need to be understanding here through all of this this study that we're doing, it, and the whole purpose of it, should be to instill in myself and others the responsibility for gossiping the gospel and just providing a crucible,
yep,
for which that kind of devotion, that kind of evangelical courage,
yep,
can be properly developed.
Yeah, well said. We'll get to this next week, but you know what one of the key factors in having a resilient community or a resilient organization is? It's when members of the group trust each other. That is a key factor. That's true in groups of five, and it's true in groups of 5,000. So we'll do that one next week. Kelsey.
I think it's important to be honest with yourself and with your church members of when it's time to feed and when it's time to be fed. I think it's important for the younger and middle-aged folks to realize when the older generations need to maybe step back and take a break and let us take over and vice versa. I think it's a constant balance, and that helps us with the changing setting. If our focus in 10 years needs to change, that younger generation needs to change it to what they're passionate about, yeah, and they can carry on for the next, yep, 10 years.
Yeah, because what is so critical, and this goes back to the stuff we did last week with intergenerational dynamics. David is next on. One of the things that we talked about with intergenerational dynamics is that groups have to listen to one another. The younger, to Kelsey's point, the younger need to listen to the older need to listen to the younger, the middle needs to listen to the older, listen to the younger, listen to each other. That listening to each other is absolutely critical. And listening to each other without being dismissive. Right? So here's kind of a little lesson in intergenerational. Younger people do not like to hear from the older people when they say something, oh, just wait until you get older. Wait until you get this. Younger people cannot stand hearing that because it's dismissive. You know, well, you know, my three-year-old is giving me fits. Well, just wait till they're teenagers. You want to end a relationship and people stop listening, say that. It is critical that instead of, well, just wait till this or wait till this, that we listen to each other. And that is a key in intergenerational dynamics in any organization, but for our purposes, in the life of a church. David.
So change is very difficult.
It is.
It's disruptive. It's hard on people. Not every one of us gets our way every time we go through a change cycle.
Yep.
And a big part of resilience or adaptability is having close enough bonds, you use the word trust,
yes,
that people stick through change cycles even when they don't get their way.
Yes.
And I just think about the life of Barry. When we first came here, and I want to talk about one of our defining issues, or identities, really, mm-hmm, is a better word. I don't like the word issue so much. We had made a decision, and we walked into this as a church, that women could, I think, lead a prayer, read a scripture, wait on table one Sunday a month, and we would tell everyone in advance,
yeah,
which Sunday, so that people who had a problem with that,
right,
could do something else.
Right.
And we've obviously continued to adapt over an extended period of time. And I was sitting here reflecting. I can see the faces and remember people who just didn't stick through that. It was too disruptive, and so they went elsewhere.
Right.
And I can also see folks who said, well, I'm not sure I'm completely comfortable, but I'm going to stick.
Yeah.
and we've evolved through that, but it's really tied to that exactly what you said, and that's having relationships with each other that are tight enough that they get you through those evolutionary phases that are actually part of any organization remaining
right.
vital over time. And you look around in groups that begin to wither, have either consciously or unconsciously made a decision not to continue to adapt to a changing environment.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just too hard. Maybe it's too disruptive. Maybe they don't want to have those conversations anymore. But it's really important for organizations that are going to continue to be resilient and vital to be able to do that.
Yeah, because the literature on resilience, well, one of the things that they say about this trust issue is that if you have a disagreement or a disruption within the organization, then that disruption happens with either your friend or an adversary. And guess which one tends to go better? You know, that's why this, again, the literature is so helpful for groups like ours, because it points to where are strengths, where are deficiencies, what do we need to give attention to, and it is absolutely key to the life cycle of an organization like ours. Jenny, Tim, and then we've got to close just a little bit early, and I'll wrap things up.
So, one of the things that I remember noticing when I first moved back to Houston and attended here is I used to kind of grieve when people would leave.
Right.
They would move off, but that's a really... strength that Bering has, that we welcome people that move to the area, and we know that we're going to lose people. And somehow within this congregation, we're able to take the good things that people bring that might have experienced them somewhere
yep.
else,
yep.
Or learn from what they didn't like somewhere else
right.
and add it to this body. So I think that's a strength, and I've learned to not be so sad when people leave, because I know there'll be new people coming,
right.
bringing more ideas and
right.
So it's a strength, I think, to live in this part of Houston and know there's going to be people in and out
sure.
of our congregation.
Sure. Yeah, it's a wonderful perspective.
Okay.
All right, Tim.
Tim's
last comment, and then we're going to come back to all of this next week. So this is really just opening an idea. So if you have anything, save it for next week. Think about it, process it, and then we'll come back. Tim.
What I was thinking about when you talked about the 50-year mark in a church, when you reach that point, you're kind of replicating Israel in the Sinai moving
sure,
into
sure.
Canaan. It's a cycle that all systems go through.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's something to be learned from Joshua, but maybe there is.
Oh, there is, for sure. So next week when we continue this conversation, sorry, that's a little off. I think it's a translation issue. There are three key components to group resilience, and we'll talk about these next week. One is the power of clusters, that is, groups within the groups and with the strengths that they build. Quantity time, not quality time, but quantity time is a key to resilience. And then what Zoli calls the resilient mind. And in a nutshell, and we'll come back to this, the resilient mind is the group as a whole, keeping resilience as a daily commitment, something that we are daily committed to. Call it adaptivity, flexibility, whatever you want to call it, but it's not just knowing what resilience is, but a commitment to it that we practice daily. And we'll come back to all of that next week. So thank you all for the conversation. We'll continue it next week.